This is Decentralized, the Decentralized Trials and Research Podcast. We gather here with friends and guests to talk about the latest ways to make research and clinical trials around the world more inclusive, more accessible, more resilient, and more sustainable, all by using decentralized methods. This podcast is recorded live on Clubhouse every Friday, 12 to 1 Eastern, on the TGIF DCT show at the Decentralized Trials Club. You can join the live sessions and add your voice every Friday at noon Eastern time with the free Clubhouse app by following the Decentralized Trials Club. And of course, subscribe to this podcast on your favorite platform to get notified of new episodes. Following the club and subscribing will also help you stay current for any of the bonus content we may drop. And now, it's time to decentralize. Well, hello and welcome to those of you joining us, whether you are here live in the room on TGIF DTRA, where we gather live on Fridays from 12 to 1 Eastern, or for those of you that are joining on a replay, perhaps listening on your favorite podcast platform, which is always a great way to catch up, especially in those sleepy summers where some folks may disappear on Fridays. Either way, we're thrilled to have you here. Remember, we do gather live so that if you ever want to jump in on the conversation, be able to bring your questions, thoughts, and ideas, it's a great way to engage. And for those of you that are here with us, we'll be keeping an eye on the chat for the first few moments. And then in the second half, we'll continue doing what we always do. We'll open up the mic in case you'd like to come share your own experiences, ideas, or questions on the topic du jour. Remember, these topics come from you, the folks in our community. And so if there's an idea that you'd like to bring forward, you don't have to be the expert. You just have to be inquisitive. Maybe you've written a blog post or have some data from a project internally that you'd like to share. Maybe you have a publication and want to coincide that with an opportunity for folks to talk to you as an author. Or maybe there's just a new development you're working on that you'd like to get exposed to this broader community. Whatever it is, let us know, and we're happy to get you onto the schedule, which is probably booking out to October right now, but October will be here in a heartbeat. I think I was in Walgreens the other day, and they had Halloween cards out on display. First of all, I didn't even know there was a market for cards that I was supposed to be buying them. But second of all, really, I'm not ready for that. Jane, I'm looking forward to today's conversation. How are you doing today, my friend?
Doing great. And by the way, Halloween candy is selling out here in Northern California, so get on it. It's a beautiful, foggy day, which means it's going to be hot.
And now, James, your strategy to buy the candy that you like, mm-hmm. and then you enjoy the leftovers, or do you buy the candy that you don't like so that you're less at risk of eating it all between now and Halloween?
Well, the truth is I don't buy any of the candy, but I notice it's already selling.
Wait, you're not giving out raisins to kids who knock on the door, are you?
I live at the top of a really steep hill.
And so they make it that far, they get a lasagna?
Yeah. They'll get the whole bag. The reason, and I'll just give you one fact, because I see, it's not as hot as Texas for sure. We had five humpbacks who breached at the same time yesterday in my little neighborhood. Epic whale shows happening every day. So come on out to NorCal.
That sounds magnificent. And we will look forward to the concomitant LinkedIn post, as I'm sure you will make connections of that to the rest of your life with a beautiful image to go with it. This is going to be a fun conversation today. I am so thrilled to welcome our guest this week, Alpa Kushalani. Alpa, I had the pleasure of meeting when I was learning about an interesting research site called Rare Disease Research. I found it interesting because of their story of delivery and rare diseases, which is an indication where so many of us are spending so much dedicated time. But Alpa just had such a unique story around her journey to doing the work that she is doing today. Because, like so many in our community, she's working by day to help make research participation more accessible. Some of us are doing that with technology, some with smarter services. But it was Alpa's story for what led her there that I thought was really special. And I'm really excited, Alpa, to welcome you here this week. Welcome.
Oh, thank you so much, Craig. Thank you so much, Jane, for giving me this opportunity to participate in this conversation with you today. Some of you are eating on your lunch or trying to, listen to this before you get to lunch. So thank you. Fridays in summer definitely is hard. But here in Georgia, the school has been in session for 4 weeks already. So it's like all, looking at homeworks and all the rest of it already. So it's fun. Well, my journey started in rare disease about 11 years ago when my oldest of three sons was diagnosed with Duchenne muscular dystrophy. So me and my husband, we live in Fayetteville, Georgia, which is about an hour south from Atlanta. And at the time of my son's diagnosis, we used to live in Chicago. I had just recently delivered my third son. I have three boys. And we went to see an orthopedic, and he said, "You know what? I think you should go see a neurologist." We had been searching for answers for 6 years. My son was born with a heart condition and had clubfoot. So we've been with specialists all along, all the 6 years, and going through a journey of ups and downs. But it was really at that point where finally our diagnostic odyssey came to an end, and we learned about Duchenne. It was heartbreaking. The first thing he said is, "You need to go and test your other boys as well," because they were really young, so you wouldn't start seeing the symptoms as yet. So, that with God's grace, they are fine, and Krishna is the only one that's impacted. I was tested, I'm negative, so it's a random mutation. And that's the first time we learned the word Duchenne. I didn't even know if I was saying it right at that point. People say Duchennes, and there are so many pronunciations still out in the world. But Duchenne muscular dystrophy essentially is a progressive muscle wasting disease where your body is not making dystrophin, and so your muscle is continuously breaking down. And clinical trials is what was really the only hope at that point because there was no approved therapies. And so that's what we jumped into, learning about trials and starting to figure out how to participate in one. So I got firsthand experience with clinical trials as we went through different trials for my son. There was one in particular that was long in terms of, several years with weekly infusions. And that was my first foray into home health and decentralized trials as a, as a caregiver and watching my son participate in it.
So so let's back up. Tell us about how Krishna is today, how old is he, and what is he up to now?
Krishna is 17 years old. He's going to be 18 in December. I don't know how to be an adult mom. This will be my first time. So I'm learning from everything that everyone says. He's a senior in high school and he wants to pursue aerospace engineering. When he was little, he wanted to be an astronaut. As he grew up and learned more about his diagnosis, he's like, "Mom, your muscle wastes when you're up in the sky, so I can't do that. So maybe I'll be a pilot." And then as he grew more, as he was older, he realized that wasn't also part of his, journey and said, "I'm going to do aerospace engineering." So that's what he wants to pursue. He is the president for their school's technology student association. He runs a Rubik's Cube club and he plays power chair soccer for the Atlanta Sting.
That's very cool. The Atlanta Sting.
Yes.
That's
So we have an Atlanta Sting team. Yes. So we have two teams there, Academy and Sting. He plays on the Academy team.
and how is his mobility?
He is within the house, he is still able to independently transfer and do things, but outside of the house, it's hard for him. And his fear of fall, he's going to be 18. So we're kind of in that delicate stage. But by natural history, he should have been in a different place. But we're grateful clinical trials and therapies have helped him be better.
Did your doctor that you were seeing at the time discuss trials as an option for you and Krishna, or was that something that you had to pursue on your own?
We were fortunate. We were at a certified Duchenne Care Center. You know, Parent Project Muscular Dystrophy has done a lot of work in establishing certified Duchenne Care Centers. So Lurie Children, where he was diagnosed, was one of them. So when Dr. Coons gave us our diagnosis, the first thing she said is, you know, I really don't wish this on anyone, but if it had to happen, you are fortunate that it's happening now because there is a lot of hope in clinical trials that your son would be able to participate in and have a better quality of life. So it was very reassuring when we were diagnosed.
Tremendous. And the study that you found for Krishna was taking place, was enrolling relatively locally, right? The Rare Disease Research, their first site is also in Atlanta.
Yes, their first site is in Atlanta. When we enrolled in the study, we actually enrolled in Chicago. And, you know, even before Chicago became available, it was Iowa. We went there and we screened in Iowa. We drove all the way, but he was too good to participate at that point. And it was a little heartbreaking to hear them call. Like, I'd driven 5 hours with him to Iowa, and I was driving back after his screening. And they called me. It was snowing, it was raining, it was just terrible. And they called me while I was still driving, and it was like, we're sorry, your son is too good. Maybe try again in 6 months when he has progressed a little more. And it was hard. That's the reality of rare diseases, that we really don't have the time. People are becoming eligible, ineligible, all of the above within a very short window. And so participation and making accessibility happen was very important to me, even at that point. So then, yes, we were in Chicago. We were there for a couple of years. 2 years of our trial was there. And then Krishna had a few falls in black ice and wheelchair was getting hard. So we're like, we got to move somewhere away from the snow. And so we started looking, where can we move in the country which has a local clinical trial site? And that's how we came upon rare disease research and moved to Atlanta. Rare
You
disease research.
moved to Atlanta. One of your real estate move criteria was to find a place to move without ice and that was close to a research site that was enrolling in
That is right.
Duchenne's muscular dystrophy.
That is right.
I
I
don't think I've
actually
ever heard
called.
anyone enter that into Zillow or Realtor.com. That is remarkable.
Yeah, you know, look at rare disease families. They are moving for everything. Okay, which state? Every state has different healthcare options. It's like there are so many considerations that come into play when you're moving. So, yes, I spoke to Dr. Fan, who was the founder of rare disease research, before we even decided to make the move. Like, okay, you know, is your site ready? Because it was still fairly new and it just established in 2016. We were moving in 2018. And it was like, okay, I just want to be sure that the trial, you know, that he's going to be able to transfer. So it was really great to have that experience. And for the first time to roll in and be able to literally go into the clinic and get versus valet parking and, you know, turns and turns around the hospital and then finally get somewhere on the 19th floor to your research visit. This was a breeze. And that's what was really amazing about rare disease research. It was designed not as an academic center, not associated with a hospital, but really purely doing clinical trials for rare diseases.
That's remarkable. And now, as a participant at in this Duchenne study enroll, and now at this site in Atlanta, home visits were made available. But these were home visits that I think had a pretty interesting model in that the visiting nurses were attached to the research site.
So that wasn't the case when we were in clinical trial. When we were participating at that time, you know, it was sponsor had already signed up with some other, you know, health provider, and they used to send nurses to our home. We had a few challenges along the way when we started in that model. And because of that, since our proximity to the site was, you know, short, we decided to do away from that and started going to the site every week for our trials. And then COVID happened, and it was just safer that way because then, you know, most of the nurses who came to our house were also nurses that worked in emergency room and others. And it was like, okay, maybe for his safety, it would be a good idea to just go to the site because they had done a good job in only allowing one family into the site at a time to get their infusions, etc. So initially that's what we did. And then later on we went back to the home health because you know you don't want to travel. You lose a whole day of school and everything. And having other younger children, I always had to figure out care for them. So that's what we did.
So, can you share an example, if you're comfortable in that first instance with home care? It sounds like there were some gaps that it wasn't meeting your needs that you opted to go into the site. Is there an example of maybe where there was a miss for you in the family?
So the first visit ever that happened for us, the nurse came in, and they know at that time it's the IP. So the box is not opened by us. It is something that the nurse comes and she opens and you know shuts off the temp tail, etc. And then there was some excursion in there. And she was trying to figure out what to do, whether she can, you know, use it, not use it, contact the site, go back and forth. And then it took a while. It took about 4 hours before everything got resolved to even get the infusion started. But it was not in her hand. That was not, you know, that she didn't know. It's just she wanted to make sure that it was okay. That was fine. Then, you know, that nurse, we finally built a relationship with her and, you know, she had to move away. The next nurse that came, she didn't even know how to prime their pump. Like she walked in and she's trying to prime the pump to get it going. And she said she wasn't trained on that. This is not the pump she was trained on. And so Krishna, I mean, by now we got used to it. So he opened up the video, he looked at it, and you know, he YouTubed it and set up the pump and primed it for her so we could get started. And I was like, okay. So that was another experience that we had. And a third one, which was very interesting, the nurse was really, really kind, very nice lady, but she just couldn't get his port. Like she kept hitting his port and wouldn't get it. And Krishna was like, you know, Mom, it's okay. You know, I don't want to go to the side. I'm going to let her try. And I was like, this is not okay. And so we got through it. And then when we finished the trial, because this thankfully the it was approved, obviously home health became the norm for us. So there's still a lot of learnings. And then Dr. Fan was like, you know, we face a lot of challenges here as a site in getting consistent data. We spend a lot of time on the phone with these nurses. Is that something you want to help change? And I was like, yes, I
So the
absolutely.
investigator pitched the idea to you of,
Yes.
do you want to come in
Yes.
and help build this out?
Yeah. She's like, you know, you've been saying this, that, you know, this is your pet peeve. I was like, and I'm like, okay, let's see. So it was never, you know, came into play as like a business model or it was nothing. It was just like similar to our trial, there was a different trial, and there were subjects who were driving in 5 hours to do their infusions because they were having challenges with nurses. And she's like, let's just solve the problem for these patients, right? You know, let's just, so we, it wasn't even like, okay, this is for all sites. It was like for our site, if we have problems with home health, we're going to go ahead and, you know, provide the service. So that's really how it started. We had one sponsor who put the faith and said, okay, you guys can go ahead and do this. And it was 2023 when we started this, and it's gone on from there.
One thing I've learned over the last couple of years is rare disease moms and dads get stuff done. And so I can certainly see why Dr. Fan was smart to kind of present that back, and why somebody like you would kind of jump at that opportunity to build this out. Can you share a little bit then about what it is, what are you doing by day, and what is Gooseberry, and why is it
So
called Gooseberry, by the way?
so I'll answer this last part of the question first. Why gooseberry? So, gooseberry is a very hardy plant, if you know, right? I mean, it grows in different environments. It can easily grow in different environments, a hardy plant. And all of our rare disease patients are also hardy in that sense. So that was the motivation behind the name. And the other thing is also we're getting a little influenced by, fruit named companies doing well. Think Apple. Remember we were talking about the Apple game a few minutes ago? So those were the two things. And lastly, you want to get a domain, and finding a domain is hard. So three things that made us choose that name. But in all honesty, the name and the thought process was already in play before I got in there in operationalizing it. So what I did before at the beginning in 2023 was all the way from working with the staff to hire the nurses, train, do all of that. And then we slowly grew where now I focus mainly on working with sponsors on the protocols and getting us started. I have a great team of nurses who train, who are, nurse trainers as well. Clinical trial managers is what we call them, and clinical trial coordinators. So we did, we were servicing trials within RDR for a couple years. And then it was like, there were sponsors who were like, you would do this for multi-center trials. And that's where Gooseberry Research became an affiliate of RDR versus being a service of RDR.
Can we talk about training? Because
Yes.
this is, it's an issue across all sorts of parts of clinical trials. And just full disclosure, as the sponsor, I was the person who was always advocating, no, we have to use this central service because I am assured of their training consistency and practices and how they vet their staff. And something about that didn't exactly work for you in your first experience, but how have you iterated that in your own business model?
So, we had a unique opportunity because we were, born out of a site. The model that we adopted, which is not prevalent, is actually bringing in the nurses to the site from wherever they are across the country. We would fly them in and train them at the clinical trial site on the exact equipment that they're going to use in the patient's home with the kit. It's literally like, hey, we give them a box like it would arrive at their home and open the box, set everything up, centrifuge, all of it, process. We have volunteers at the site who are very kind to, be there to offer up their blood. And then they do an entire visit and do an assessment. So
So you
then
do a
we know what.
simulation with
Yes.
all of the equipment and literally what you'll need to touch and use in the video. Oh, that's awesome. I
Yeah.
love that.
With not just the patient, but if a patient, we usually also try, if at all, we can plan a visit for the nurse to come at a time when the patient is at the site. It just makes it so much, at least give them an introduction. So when the nurse is walking into the patient's home, it's not, there's a lot of anxiety, as rare disease parents, it's a lot that you deal with every day, and things are different every time you're walking in. Like, it's crazy. I was talking to you guys yesterday, and a few hours later, we had a washing machine leak, and it's literally water from the ceiling in my kitchen. And I'm like, okay, just another day. And so that's it. We just all rolled with the punches, right? So it was anything we can do to make it easier. Many of the trials don't fail because of recruitment or enrollment in rare diseases. It's because we are all, that's our only opportunity. That's our only shot many of the times. So we enroll, but retention over a period of time is where the challenges come in. And it's the human connection. At the end of the day, you really are humans, whether you have a rare disease or not, and you want that human connection. So that's what we are trying to establish by making this not about a subject ID and not about a protocol and not about a blood draw, but really about how it is meaningful to these families.
So, with all this knowledge and now your flourishing business, what's your lesson learned and best practice to offer to sponsors? Because remember, I was the person who said, no, I need rigor and consistency. Do I get that more if I use the service that the site has already established? Or do I, which model should I use? We get this question all the time, by the way.
Obviously consistency is important because you want to ensure that the data is collected the same way using the same source documents that everybody is using the same. So consistency is important. But at the same time, you need to value the input. You're asking the principal investigator to be signing off on delegation logs saying that, yes, they're responsible for the visits that are being conducted. So we want to ensure that the PIs feel comfortable with what the nurses are seeing and the data that they're collecting in the patient's home. So lesson learned, first one is really good site communications. Whether, like for us now that we are independent, it's not just going to be RDR site patients, but other site patients that we are also supporting. So ensuring there is good site communication, ensuring there is transparency with the site as well as the sponsor. Like we are like when a nurse visit happens, confirming and letting them know what happened. All of those things are important to establish the comfort level and confidence in your service. So that is one thing we learned. Initially, that was not some we learned it over time that okay, you cannot over communicate over in rare diseases. So that was one of the main things. The other thing is having good backup nurses at all times. Is we had a situation once where one and one only time where there were some challenges in the visit and it was at the end of the visit window. And we had a nurse that drove pretty much all night to get there the next morning to do that single blood draw so the subject did not have to fly. Because if that didn't happen, the subject wouldn't get the next infusion, which they were designed, the safety lab had to be done before they could travel to the site. And what if they came to the site and the lab was off? Then that's a lot of travel that a family has to do. So having a team that truly is aligned with your purpose is also important. And
Got it.
it's like these are not mini adult studies, right? A lot of times what happens is many of the organizations look at it as, okay, this can be easily done. You can't send adult oncology nurses onto these patients' home and expect them to have the same results. They do need some peds training, which in rare diseases, 80% of the patients are pediatrics.
So share a bit more on that as both a person executing these home visits and a person who is a beneficiary of these home visits in your own house. What are some ways that could or should look different by having a visiting nurse who is specially trained for rare disease and peds?
First, obviously, how much experience they have in pediatrics is the first thing that's important. Second is, no training, and good training, right? Clinical research. Most of the nurses are not. They're not researchers in their daily life. They are still doing standard of care. And so ensuring that they understand Alcova documentation, they're not used to this much data. So making it easier for them, eSource and other, technology now is making it so much easier for us to be able to conduct these trials in a very consistent way. So that would be something that I'm a big proponent, training, and training. Workforce development is what is going to make it easier for us to do this. And that is really our mojo. Say that's what we depend on. I was reading this report recently in GlobeWire from Research on Market report, which said that the DCT is expected to grow from 9.6 billion in 2024 to almost 21.3 billion in 2030. That's a 14% annual growth rate. And if we want to do that successfully, and it also said rare disease is going to be the biggest adopter here. And I was like, okay, if we got to do this right, then we want to ensure for a very small data set, which is there are, studies are like 10, 15 patients in a study. And so every visit and every data point becomes important. So good manuals, good, guidelines. We do checklists. We have checklists for the nurses too at every visit that have you done all of these things. We have quality team that is going to review. As soon as they finish the visit, they send in their source documents and those are reviewed before it goes to the site, reducing some of the burden that the CRCs have to take on when these things are not in place. So it's really listening to what the need is from the sites and the sponsors.
I'm an operator here, and now I'm going to dig a little. How often do you get to use eSource at the site wherever you're, or have you ever used eSource as a way to collect the data in the visit with the patient?
So far the studies that we're doing are all paper source, but we, as an initiative from our side, have partnered with Devesa Health, which is a clinical trial management software, and then we use that. So our nurses, it's become a backup for us where we have given them iPads and they take it to the homes, and it's a backup data in terms of for us to be sure that is working. We came across certain issues when it comes to network not being available in many of the remote places that we work. We have one study where the family is out in a forest living in a trailer, right? And it's challenging enough to conduct the visit there itself. A nurse travels with a folding table because there's not even enough place to set up. So they travel with the folding table, go there, set up, and conduct the visit. So we're still learning. eSource is something that, is not as well adopted yet in the trials that we are working. Paper is still the one that the sponsors are inclined and the sites are feeling more comfortable with.
That's interesting. And I ask you because I have a former colleague on this call with me, and we were building an e-source system for exactly that purpose quite a
Yeah.
while ago. Huh. And yeah, we did some interesting simulations and had a few of those same issues about network connectivity, but we weren't in a forest. We were actually in a big research institution.
Oh, wow. It was just clogged network and busy.
Clogged, or who knows, maybe near the radiation suite. I don't know. But these are the things that sometimes when you're at your desk, you don't think about, or I didn't think about when I was designing trials.
Yeah.
I see an interesting question in the chat, and it is about the time for us to open the floor to questions. So you can come off mute, or raise your hand, or drop it in the chat.
Carolyn, did you want to bring your question forward, or would you prefer we read it out of the chat? Please read. So, Caroline in the audience, Alba, is asking, what about inclusion of investigators and RN and family with established endpoints for these studies? Jane, are you following that one?
I think that it's how often are those people consulted about the endpoints used in these rare disease studies and whether or not they might fit a setting for, I'm interpreting, I don't know for
Yeah.
sure.
So,
You got a green check for that one, Jane.
okay.
Good job.
All right. Where we come into play from a gooseberry perspective is really after the protocol has already been designed, right? Sometimes we get the opportunity where we participate initially, where the sponsors are still designing what their protocol is going to look like, and based on the endpoints, which assessments make sense to be collected at home and which assessments make sense to be collected in the clinic, because they are either a primary endpoint, secondary endpoint. So it depends on that. As a mother of a child with a rare disease, I have been involved in protocol design with several different pharma organizations, especially around what is burdensome, what is not for patients. But PIs are always, at least to my understanding, RDR PIs have been consulted in the past when protocol and endpoint design is being done. So they are included. In terms of RN, from a nurse's perspective, I think we, have not, I cannot say that we had that opportunity yet. There was one particular sponsor who did take the effort to come to us and say, hey, this is all we need to collect. And in this visit, you're going to have, even an ambient, refrigerated, frozen, all of it, and then going to two different labs. One is going to Europe in some lab, and one is going to a central lab in the US. And can you guys handle all of this, right? So that was one time when we were consulted and involved in that conversation. But most of the times we get it when the protocol is already developed, and you wish that somebody had asked the question sooner.
Because I would imagine you'll get stuck with some endpoints that just don't fit in the home and will leave the patient kind of trapped, having to go into the clinic just for one assessment to take place.
Right. Functional assessments typically fall in that, obviously not having enough of a long hallway to have somebody do a 6-minute walk, which I still don't know why we do make people do, but anyways, so
That's right.
those do.
We're going to have them like that example you gave earlier. Park at the valet, navigate the 12 floors of the hospital from
I
the
know.
parking garage to the clinic, all that just so that we can watch you walk for 6 minutes in our hallway.
And we've done that. We have families who have to fly in across country for a blood draw for one of those. It's just hard. It's just because many of these diseases are not that well understood in natural history and comparison. I'm going to be honest. Before I started being on this side of the world in terms of being a part of making clinical trials available, I was the parent on the other side, like, what are you doing? Why can't this go faster? Why is this taking forever? And why do we have to do all this? But now I appreciate a little bit better on why the trials are designed this way. If you see the unfortunate, in the last 3 or 4 months, we have four CRLs that have come for rare diseases. These Barth patients, these Duchenne patients, all of these, they don't have time. Time is not on their side. And so at some point, we're like, okay, if this is what it's going to take to get this drug approved, we are going to do it.
Yeah, but those Barth, the sponsor in that case, in my book, did not design something wrong. They just had bad timing of the flip of an administration with different expectations and roles dropped on them and their patients, which is just insufferable.
But I think you're raising a really good conundrum here, and I'm really grateful that as the end user, you are now in the process and starting to understand some of the mud that we have to get through to really demonstrate safety and efficacy of these products. The conundrum for me, in part, is that I hear very clear messages from FDA and other regulators. Like, we understand we need new endpoints, we need digital endpoints, we need to let trials catch up to what's possible. And then you see the CRL letters. And so I know they're working on trying to level set within the agency, like these people think it's possible, so why don't these people think it's possible and how? But it's going to take us a while. And that's why I think having people like you involved is so helpful because you can really navigate and give specific examples about how endpoints or their collection impede the ability to get the data that they're seeking with rigor. There's a whole other thing there too, but
We could spend an entire hour talking about biomarkers and endpoints and like what you're collecting and why. Sometimes I'm like, you just took 8 tubes of, do you really think you need all of that? all of that. You know, when is it less is more, right? But in rare disease, that doesn't seem to be the case. All of these sponsors are trying to collect as much data as they can so that when they come upon the FDA and they request for something, they're able to analyze and bring that forward. You know, you're not going to do a biopsy again and again on the, you know, even when these are collected, make a difference. Sometimes these biopsies are done sooner than they should have, and it does not show any difference, and the efficacy of your drug is missed to be collected.
Last trial I
And
was in, I think I had some visits where I gave 26 tubes of blood.
oh my God.
But it was a sub-study and I voluntarily did it because they were trying to figure out some scientific things. So it was all good. But when that's the standard instead of a sub-study, it's a problem.
Yeah.
Right. So what do you think is going to happen in terms of, say, the use of digital health technology along with the in-home visits, like sensors?
You know, wearable devices are becoming a norm. Like, we're talking about a study where there is also going to be sleep, you know, devices that are mats that are put in for while the subject is sleeping, so you can track their, you know, apnea information and others. Wearable devices are becoming a norm, and I think it's important because when you walk in, like, imagine the same thing, having have driven 3 hours sitting in your car, you reach the side, then you go through this whole parking and the heat and the cold, and you're hungry, that you're crying already because you're like, okay, mom, I need food before I can do this. You get through all that, you get to the site, and then you do the assessment. It's not your best performance, right? It's not what you're seeing every day versus being in your home. So I do believe that devices and collecting data from that is going to be very helpful and should become part of most studies going forward. And technology is becoming better. AI is helping analyze some of this data. I don't know, I'm on the fence with AI on that, but but it is an opportunity to use it right.
Well, I have to agree that the ability to create flexibility and options for patients, in many cases, the rate limiter will be our endpoints, and our ability to change those requires significant advanced planning to ensure that you have a qualified and appropriate endpoint ready to go when that study starts, which is certainly a luxury that some of the big pharma are able to manage and build into their clinical development plans and invest in the digital endpoint equivalent of a 6-minute walk test. A little harder for the smaller biotechs that are advancing some of the more innovative molecules and rare, but still such an important opportunity. And one that, can be a dish best served paired, that, companies working together, like we see at DTRA and Dyme and Citi, so many of these spaces where the cost and the risk of investing in a digital endpoint can be mitigated by finding friends. I mean, let's face it, no one company ultimately should own an endpoint. They're best served if it's an endpoint that's used widely by lots of stakeholders so that investigators and prescribers and payers are all familiar with it and can trust it. But without that, yeah, we're stuck, driving people or flying people. God, what a terrible example, flying people in to do a 6-minute walk test. That just seems insane.
So
And you
you
know,
got me curious. Do we have a validated, approved digital 6-minute walk test
No.
replacement yet? There's
No.
good, there's some good published
Yeah.
data, but there's no instance. Like if you look at the libraries of places where a digital endpoint has been used, we're still dragging people
No
in.
approvals
The
based on that
DVA,
data,
the
or even.
DVA is becoming a part. Like, you know, there's the video assessments that are being conducted in the patients' homes. That is starting to become a norm, at least from my experience in the Duchenne world. I cannot speak for others, but I see
And the
that.
limiter there, Alpa, is it? Do you have a straight 10-meter path in your home to be able to do that.
I know. Then they say go to the library or something, and I'm like, okay.
Set up your camera in the library and have your child start to just walk for 6 minutes.
It is interesting. But anyway, when it comes to adoption of decentralized elements, I don't think it's a question of why. It's really a question of how now. You know, everybody realizes that that is an important aspect of making trials more accessible and making it easier. So when it comes to how, that's the question that we're like, you know, Mahatma Gandhi said, right? Be the change you want to see in the world. So the change we want to see is more patients participating with less burden. And that's why it's important to ensure that we can give the confidence to the sponsors that we know what we're doing. And I love Gooseberry for making that possible.
And by the way, it's a great call out that you have there in that example in Duchenne's around using video, because, while one might say if you're a sort of digital medicine nerd, you might say, well, I should just use the accelerometer that's on the phone in the patient's pocket or on their wrist on a watch, and I should be able to track and quantify the equivalent of a 6 minute walk test all day long, right? And get much more robust data. And that's a little daunting for folks in terms of change. But as you're pointing out, the ability to run the familiar 6 minute walk test, but to do it on camera. So you're using the conventional endpoint, but you're using a modern technology to help make that endpoint easier to collect, is a great way to mitigate some barriers there. I remember, Jane, at CNS Summit a couple of years ago, I met a woman, Megan, who has a company, I think based out of Paris. She had won their CNS Summit pitch competition with her company that was focused on using video in that way. Makes sense.
Well, and it mitigates all that risk around patient identity and verification that it is the actual participant, which comes up sometimes, and that just goes away in the video. How quickly do you think most sponsors are willing to make protocol changes based on patient feedback? Ooh, loaded question.
Think so too.
What do you think?
I think earlier in the study where the patients are probably, we don't have a large number of patient pool. Like if they see enrollment challenges, I've seen this happen time and again, right? You start with the study and then you realize you're having enrollment challenges. At that time, it's more willing to make that change. But then when the study has already been in and has a few patients and has been active for a while, it gets a little bit harder because then what happens to all the data that has already been collected, right? So there are it is at different points in time, changes do take place, but it really depends how far this at least that's what I mean. I cannot speak for what it but generally, but that's what I've seen so far in my experience.
Well, so I actually had the opportunity to participate in a research study with Tufts Center for the Study of Drug Development. And the question was, how often do protocol amendments happen and why? And we categorized them. And it was cross-industry. It was maybe not a surprise. The number one reason was patient recruitment. Safety came up a lot, right? Like you've got a new signal. But the hidden insight that we gathered was that the timing of the protocol amendment was often timed to when you could kind of no longer put off an amendment because it was linked to the metrics of the performance of the medical writers and the medical monitors. And I was like, oh, that's so fascinating. Right? So measurement drives behavior. That was my takeaway. But I will say that, to Nisha's point, I think that patient input and site input is very important in driving the amendment process.
Sometimes it's just not practical to perform everything that they have laid out within a particular visit. And so, as you rightly said, the sites, the PIs, and all will go back and patients, it's like it's not practical for us to do this. Like, I'll tell you one of the studies where it was like day one is supposed to be a visit at the site, PK, and then day two, PK, which is the 24-hour collection, had to be at home. Now, think about it of someone who's flying and coming in to do their visit. Now, you're expecting, okay, based on the time at which you got collected, your next day you'll be in your home and have someone, and think about coming cross country, right? So, those things are initially thought to be great. I'm not keeping them on site for 2 days, but then you realize that there's really no other option. You got to keep them overnight because your day two collection is not going to happen otherwise.
That question from Nisha is certainly an interesting one. And I would think that when it comes to the endpoints, that the FDA's PFDD process, their patient-focused drug development process, really challenges sponsors to make sure that they're listening to patients around the endpoints that matter and measuring what matters. But it is interesting that doesn't necessarily, we like to hope it carries over to other operational realities with the protocol, but doesn't necessarily. I think in an ideal state, we're not doing protocol changes because we got it right the first time. But we also know that the FDA guidance, the EMA recommendations really want to see these decentralized elements recognized in the protocol. And so it makes it a little trickier just to slip these things in after the fact that really needs to be captured and documented there.
And the
Right.
silver lining there in the future is I think that's going to be helpful for us to actually quantify the adoption of DCT methods over time.
Yes, I know it was COVID helped people realize that it's more possible. There was less interest in it before that probably than it is now, where it's like, okay, we know we can do this remotely. There people got creative at that time. But I'm starting to see that fizzle out a little bit because now again, many of the trials, and I'm like, why? Like, why are you making people do all this at the site? It is a lot. The burden is a lot. So patients are becoming more vocal because now we are also used to having more assessments done at home. So I think we are at this, precipice of making it finally come together. There are tools, AI, technology is becoming more advanced. There are patients who are more vocal. And there is data of having have done this successful. So adoption, there's no alternative at this point.
Maybe you need to come to our annual meeting. And I'm not kidding. Like the theme of the meeting this year, which is our fifth meeting, is maintaining momentum.
Okay, I'll,
You have all the data, like you said. We have the tools. We have the evidence that it's been acceptable from a regulatory perspective. We have it written into guidance at ICH and FDA. So then, what else do you need?
If you're a listener today and you're not sure what annual meeting Jane is referring
Thank
to,
you, Craig.
that would be the DTRA annual meeting that's taking place November 6th and 7th up in Cambridge, Massachusetts. This year hosted with our friends at Microsoft at the New England R&D Center over there in Kendall Square. And as Jane mentioned, we'll be covering a range of topics related to maintaining progress and momentum because we know it's a challenging year and it has been a challenging 2 years or more for many, both individually in terms of stability for their own roles, as well as organizationally in trying to keep progress happening in just a challenging macroeconomic environment. But we know people are getting some great things done. And so we want to make sure that the hows for how they're doing that are getting amplified so that if there are tips and lessons learned that we can all do better around, fabulous. There is a pre-meeting workshop that I don't think we're ready to drop for folks yet, but on Wednesday the 5th in the afternoon is a pretty cool workshop emerging. But Jane, I don't want to steal any thunder there, so we'll share more on that in the coming weeks.
It's a work in progress, but it's really a compelling topic, and I'm thrilled that there is interest in the topic, and I'm just going to tease you that way.
I'd also mentioned a woman, Megan, I had met at CNS Summit with a cool company, and I have no relationship to Megan other than thinking she was pretty cool. So I should follow up. That was Megan Conroy, and her company is Capture Proof, which focuses on video-based endpoints for clinical research. So a cool person to bounce ideas off of if you're interested in that space. Not a part of the DTRA house and family that we've had yet, but maybe we will in the future.
Oh,
So
thank you.
this
And
whole
here in the US, there's
conversation.
also Casimir, who've done the DVA work. So they're somebody to look out for as
Yeah.
well.
What was that? What's the name of that one, Alpa?
Casimir? Casimir, yes. It was started
Casimir.
actually by the JET, the JET Foundation, Christine McSherry. Again, another mom who's like, we got to get this done right. So she was the one who originally started it. But yeah, DVA. For DVA that's been used, Casimir is the name of the company to keep it
Excellent.
within.
Good resources.
I got a suggestion for a future topic based on what you were talking about, Alpa.
Yeah.
So noodle on this, Craig, and our audience, but what could we do to help participants and their families understand that in some ways trials are a Where's Waldo experience? When you said my son couldn't be in because he was too well. And on the flip side, I've worked with someone this year who thought she wasn't going to qualify for a trial because she wasn't worthy. That was her word. I'm like,
Yeah.
we got to debunk this and s help people understand this Where's Waldo element to trials is for a very specific reason, but that doesn't make it feel good.
I know. It's just the way it's communicated. That's what matters. Like my son looked at me that day in the car. I still remember it. I was really trying hard to not be crying and be able to see the road. And he looks at me and he's like, Mom, I'm sorry, I failed. So it was like, it's just hard. And that's not the feeling we want them to be, but it's hard to, it is a difficult place because that's your only hope. There are not many options at that point in time. So yes, I like your topic and I have far more appreciation for that today on why we have to be so specific and why are we designing eligibility criterias as strict as they are. Because if we keep it broad, like, examples with labels being broad as well, and then not, it not working out in favor. So I understand that better now. So definitely, we can have you could have some people who are more knowledgeable on deciding why to be included in your future session. I would love to listen to it.
You know, that one takeaway for folks here might be that I've seen a lot of folks now trying to avoid the term screen failure and find other terms for that. I think right now some of the alternative terms are a little clunky, but I realize the reason, and the reason is your example of Krishna. No patient should walk away saying that they failed, and no study operator or study team should be communicating that the patient failed in some way. The study failed the patient, not the other way around. And these individuals who are unmatched deserve, a better name than being called a failure. Well, we are at the top of the hour. This flew by together, Alpa. I hope folks take advantage of connecting with you on LinkedIn or other platforms. Certainly, if there's other thoughts or questions or ideas here, it has really been an honor to hear your story and your journey and how Krishna is doing. And grateful for how you've really brought such amazing action and bringing scale to those experiences that you had so that others can as well.
Well, thank you so much again for the opportunity to share. And yes, anyone who's listening, I'm more than happy to just be here if that's someone you need to. You're going through a hard day as a rare disease mom, parent. I'm happy to participate. If you are working on protocols that you need input on, I'm happy to participate. And most importantly, if you're designing DCT trials, please do connect with us at Gooseberry Research and give us an opportunity to support you.
Thanks so much, everyone. See you all
Thank
soon.
you. Bye.
Bye-bye.